And welcome to Unreal Bluegrass. I'm Steve Martin. This is the portion of the program where we usually always fit in an interview with, as the opening credits say, the legend and those becoming. Ken Irwin is a friend of mine. He's a legend. I would never tell him this to his face because he's too humble, but he was a co-founder of Rounder Records. So I had the opportunity, was asked actually to sit with Ken on a live stage at Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival. It was titled the Grassroots Stage. It was packed. There were people standing. And we had microphones so people could address Ken, questions that they had and things that I missed. So we're going to start off with the introduction of that. The book that we kind of circle around is Oh, Didn't They Ramble by David Menconi. Forward by Robert Plant. Earlier in the program, you heard Robert Plant and Alison Krauss. Well, Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, yes, Led Zeppelin and Union Station founder, recorded on Rounder Records. Very loyal to Rounder Records. So we're going to begin then with the introduction of Ken Irwin. So had a great time. There was some ambient festival music and noises off in the distance, but the recording actually is very, very well done. The whole recording process, I will give credit to the staff at Grey Fox. They did a great job. Turned around quickly and, boy, really clear right from the stage. You can even hear the people that approach the microphone, questions they have. All good questions, by the way, and all honored to be there to be able to address them. The Ken Irwin, Rounder Records, big deal. Big deal in my life. Big deal in the life of bluegrass and Americana music. So let's get started with that. Thank you so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. This is part one of my visit with Ken Irwin at Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival. I think it's recording. All right, I think we're recording now. Thanks, everybody, for coming by. You know Rounder Records. You probably know Ken Irwin. I'm going to say something, Ken. Ken's a friend of mine. I'm going to say something for all of us who would say the same thing. When Rounder Records was coming out and when Rounder Records existed, we knew, searching through record stores, that if it said Rounder on it, it was good, whether we knew what the artist was or whether we knew what the music was. Rounder was just instantly spoke quality, thought behind it, thoughtfulness, and the need to record and preserve great music. That's what I think it meant to a lot of us. And Rounder Records was just this amazing thing that we could stumble onto. And there's a book that I got all kinds of post-it notes in. Oh, Didn't They Ramble, written by David Menconi. It's a foreword by Robert Plant. It's available here up on the corner. And I've read it and stuck all my post-it notes in it. That's just how my brain works. But we only have one brain we really need here, and that's Ken Irwin, our guest. Ken, how are you?
Doing fine. Go okay. Ahead.
The story of Rounder Records is, here, let me see if I can summarize it for this, because I still think this still works. We'll get into the personnel and all kinds of stories that are not in this book. But the guiding principle for Rounder Records started out being, do we like this? Now, you tell me another business entity, whether it's in music or whatever, that had as a starting principle, do we like this? That's what we're going to guide our music by. Do we like it? And they did like a lot of it. And they were very selective about how they chose things. They were all three connected in their interest in music and preserving music and getting great music. And to me, it's just an amazing coming together of you and the other principals of Rounder. So, Ken, I'd like to talk a little bit about how in the heck Rounder came around. How did Rounder start put together?
Well, I was hitchhiking coming back from Fiddler's Convention, and the typical story, and got picked up by a young couple who didn't want the girl I was hitchhiking with to be out at night, and so they invited us to spend the night with them. And it turned out that he, Ken Davidson, had rediscovered some artists who had recorded in the late 20s and early 30s and had made new recordings. And we spent the night and we didn't have anything to do the next day. So Ken and his wife, Sherry, brought us around to meet two of their artists, Clark Hessinger, the legendary fiddler, and Billy Cox, who wrote A Filipino Baby, and Sparkling Brown Eyes that Joe Val did a number of times. And I came back and I called my college roommate at the time and said, hey, this guy started a record company and he didn't know anything about graphics. He had this little photo Kodak, maybe, you know, 3 inches square, and a yellow cover, block letters, didn't have any liner notes. And I said, hey, you know, we know this guy who designs books for Boston University. We know ethnomusicologists who go to the concerts at Harvard. And, you know, why don't we start a record company?
Why not? Let's just start a record company. That's what I loved about you guys. It was just, why don't we just do this? No one told you not to, so you did it.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Well, that was it.
I interrupted you at exactly the right time.
Yeah.
So from making that decision early on to go ahead and make a record company, which I'm glad you did that. I'm still amazed that based on that information you decided to do it. How did the three original members of what became Rounder, how did you guys come together? Because you were diverse. You had a similar interest in good music and finding good music and making it available. But as far as the three persons that I think of as Rounder Records in those days, how did the three of you come together?
Well, my first partner was Bill Nowlin, who was my college roommate, thrown together before computers were dealing with that at all. And we almost didn't become roommates because the letter that he sent me when he found out we were roommates, I was from Westchester County, which is north of New York, and 20-30 miles. And he wrote to me, seeing as you're from upstate New York, you must be a Republican. And who would you be voting for in the upcoming senatorial election between Jacob Javits and Robert Thompson Pell? And I thought about it for a minute and wrote back and told him I was a Dodger fan and liked folk music. So it almost didn't happen.
Was it Brooklyn Dodgers or
Brooklyn
after
Dodgers?
Oh, see, that was a sneak, I think, on your part. You were trying to connect with New York. Okay.
And then our third partner is Marion Leighton, now Marion Leighton Levy, who was my girlfriend at the time, and we decoupled not too long after that, but we're much better friends than we were back then. She lives about 10 minutes down the road and is certainly among my best friends.
You began listening. I happen to know that Ken used to always, whatever town he went to, found a record store. Every time I've seen you in Raleigh, you're coming back from another unknown record store that you still cruise through record stores.
I still do that, but part of it is that I got a 1953 jukebox and I'm looking for 45s for it.
So early on, this idea is coalescing, and I do think of the whole Rounder concept as this thing that just kind of came together by whatever cosmic forces or whatever. You would go listen in all the different clubs that you could and try to pay attention to something that you might like, and then you could maybe try to figure out a way to record them. And I read in the book about Club 47, which I didn't know about, but it seems to be an early pivotal point for your efforts to get Rounder into that scene.
Yeah, Club 47 is legendary. It's one of the most famous folk clubs. Joan Baez played there early on, Taj Mahal, Tom Rush. Their roster, the schedule was so incredible. It's very much like Steve described his feelings about Rounder, is we felt we could go down there on any night and the music would be great and diverse. They had Muddy Waters Blues Band, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, virtually anybody in folk music with a broad range of folk would come through there. Old-timey people, Doc Watson, when he first came up with Clarence Ashley, an old-time musician who recorded back in the, I think, in the late 20s and 30s. But they had great, great booking. And this is before, you know, the Google machine came around. So we just trusted what they were booking and went down there often 3 or 4 times a week.
So you're seeing the live music that will later become incorporated into this Rounder concept, but you were not limiting to, you weren't there trying to find, let's find bluegrass, let's find blues. You were looking for
good music that you liked, and it happened to be whatever you could find. It wasn't, you weren't trying to exclude anything. You were just open to ideas that came through the stage, is what I understand.
Yeah, it largely started with old-time music and bluegrass. The first two records were old-time. George Pegram, a two-fingered banjo player, and the Spark Gap Wonder Boys. And we recorded those two albums. George Pegram we bought for $125 from Ken Davidson. The full recordings.
Oh, okay, all right.
And then Spark Gap Wonder Boys we recorded at MIT and Harvard radio stations for the cost of tape, which was $7.50.
You also listened to Alan Freed, because I like this point, because there used to be radio that was accessible to people that had the mindset like all of the people at Rounder, and you could listen to a broadcaster, Alan Freed, who gave you all of that spectrum of things that you could later find quality in and want to pursue.
Yeah, not only did I listen to Alan Freed, but I actually went to his house. My father was a freelance writer, and I suggested that he do an article on Alan Freed, and he actually followed up and did one. The big thing with Alan Freed is that he was playing a lot of doo-wop, mostly African-American groups, and I just loved that. And later on, when I heard bluegrass, it was very similar to especially the gospel quartets, with the high tenor and the bass and the beautiful and soulful harmonies.
See, that's the thing. It's you're looking for, you're appreciating the vocal harmony aspect of it. You like the music, but that triggers something to where you recognize the vocal harmony, especially, which, as you stated before, it blends right into what you heard in early bluegrass music because of the harmonies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just again, your ability to pull all this thing in and make it work in so many different venues is just, to me, it's the whole story. Can I read the manifesto? Can I read into this to the audience? By the way, it's a great book. It's over there, stacks of them here. This is mine. This was the Rounder Records. I'll call it a manifesto, because you're making a comment.
Okay.
And I'm going to read this whole thing for you, because it's just, I thought, wow. Okay,
and then this appeared in most of our very early recordings until we heard some objections.
And you might be able to tell why once I start reading this, although to me it's perfectly fine. Here was what I call the manifesto. Rounder Records is an anti-profit collective that produces records and concerts and distributes other very small record labels. It is dedicated to remaining an anti-profit service group to make available important traditions of American culture that are largely non-commercial. Traditional American string band and bluegrass music, black country blues and string band music, and protest music, both past and present. Our form of work organization is a worker-controlled, with no bosses, and with all finances in common. All money received from records and sold is reused to make future records. We envision our function as that of a service organization, an alternative to commercial record companies, with implications of this alternate structure to continue serving people cultural, ethically, and in an anti-profit. Again, you want to really stress the anti-profit.
Yeah.
It starts off the paragraph and also you end hard with that. The anti-profit mode in the new world as we are working towards now. I cannot imagine why. See, it resonates. It resonates. I can't imagine why record distributors or...
It was more the other labels.
Yeah. Well, so the effect of this was what? Once this goes out of everything, the labels who were thinking, wait a minute.
Yeah, we're working really hard. I remember one of the other record labels, Tacoma, that I think for bluegrass purposes put out the two Mike Aldridge wonderful solo records, but they also did a lot of Leo Kottke and John Fahey and a lot of other acoustic music, and I thought that they were just incredible in that they were taking $10,000 a year. I mean, this is 1970, but still, I thought that was a load of money to be taking as salaries, and we were taking no salaries at that point. We were living off our whatever other jobs. Bill was a college teacher. Marion worked for a while at a Greek seminar in the Boston area. And I worked for one semester at Lowell Tech teaching psychology until I got fired, basically, for bringing my class to a Jethro Tull concert with without getting permissions. And a lot of my students, you know, talked their way in. I'm with Mr. Irwin's psychology class, and they got in. We had the best class ever. It was adolescent psychology, and we, you know, the talk was all about how people were dressed and how they talked. And the next day, the president, the dean, and one other person I forgot called up. And at the end of the semester, they decided to use my salary for getting new desks instead.
So what was the Jethro Cole? What was their album that was current? Do you remember when you saw them? No, you don't. All right. Still, I love the idea. Can you imagine an MBA program that lists as part of its itinerary, we want to teach you to be not just nonprofit, anti-profit, and we want to teach you to not make money, and we want to teach you to be very vocal about it to the point of being anarchist in the sense that could be. Can you imagine an MBA project and someone with an MBA coming out, going to the bank and said, I want a loan, and here's what I want to do. I never want to make a profit. I'm just doing this. And I just think it's not going to work.
It was hard enough for banks later on when we, you know, sort of changed over to understand what we're doing. The record business is very confusing. I'm sure the book business is very confusing, too. It's very, very hard to predict. It's not like most businesses where you can, you know, look at a business plan and have a very good idea. And the other thing that happened, we were a fairly small account. In fact, we were a very small account. And so we would get new people all the time. And so we would have to train them and explain how we worked forever and ever.
By the way, we have a microphone set up here, and there's no question time or whatever. If you have a question that you want to ask, because I've said a lot and Ken's answered a lot, feel free to just let me know and come up. But I am going to cover, you can come up whenever you want to, and it could be topics we've covered, could be topics that aren't in the book, which there's a lot of those. There's a lot of incidents in those early days that are, you get to tell at some point. But so, you know which ones I'm talking about. Let's skip to the very famous 0044 album, the Jed Crow in the New South. See, everybody remembers that. Yeah. So that to me was another watershed in my listening to music and also my deeper appreciation of Rounder Records. That's a fascinating story by itself.
Yeah. So we were at the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival, and J.D. was playing. This is probably 1974, early 75, and he had that great band with him, but we thought that they would never be interested in working with a bunch of hippies who were just starting out. So we approached J.D. about doing a banjo record. And he politely declined, and we went back to our record table where we were set up, and we had lunch, which was fairly typical for us at that time, which was bananas and Cool Whip. And by the way,
when we're finished, there's banana and Cool Whips for everybody. Go ahead, Ken.
So. We're back there eating, and then J.D.'s manager comes over, Hugh Sturgill, and said, you know, we'd like to talk with you. And so we went back, and they approached us about doing a band record. You know, at that point, we had done a Del McCoury record, but nobody knew who Del McCoury was. This is way before he moved to Nashville. He was living in rural Pennsylvania, and trying to think who else, Ted Lundy and the Southern Mountain Boys, but nobody really of note. And so having JD, who was probably, if you graded people, they were probably a B-plus, A-minus group, ready to become one of the, you know, most famous groups in the music. So we were sort of shocked and obviously pleased. And
it impacted Rounder Records, not just the listeners, but Rounder Records had reflected the importance of that album because of the notoriety that it got. I mean, you had other things happening at Rounder Records, which may have happened, but that certainly helped get you.
Yeah, it was a huge stamp of approval, just that, you know, JD, who is so respected in the industry, when I say industry, I mean from other band members, you know, would make this decision and go with the New Kids on the Block was just huge. And we were flabbergasted and thrilled.
Gentlemen right here, you want to ask a question?
Are we on?
We okay. can hear.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Since we're talking about Rounder 0044, for those that may not be aware, the original cover art was controversial. Some people found it humorous. Some people were offended by it. How many copies were printed before you changed the cover art?
Unfortunately, the all the paperwork was thrown away. We had all that figures. I would guess it probably was 1,000 to 2,000.
And just an aside for that, there's an event called Record Store Day that's held every year where limited editions of albums are released, and Rounder released 0044 on Record Store Day, what, 5, 6 something years ago?
Yeah.
And they used the original cover art.
Used the original cover art, and there was one outtake on that, Why Don't You Tell Me So, which... In retrospect, we can't figure out why it didn't make the original record, because it's a really good cut.
My story that I heard about that controversial cover, which if you don't know, JD had his hand configured in a certain way that some people were offended by. The story I got from a member of that band is that he did that because it was cold out, and he was mad at the photographer for taking so long, and that was his last... Have you ever heard that before?
It was cold, I know that.
That's what I was told by a member of that band. That he said, I can tell you exactly why he did it. He was freezing and the photographer was taking so long. That was his way of saying, we're done here. So that's what happened. That was his little message to the photographer.
Yeah, so going back, this is 1975. You know, what we're looking at is a 1-inch square, and we look and everybody's smiling. You know, that's so rare in any kind of album cover. So we thought it was great, and we sent it off, and it came back, and there was one major promoter in the area who just, you know, called up and really gave it to us. And we were starting out, you know, we were trying to make a good impression, and so we changed it, but it took a little while. I think JD still... had a whole box of them. Might be worth something now.
I guess he could give them as Christmas gifts, I suppose, as a state could.
Yeah.
That was one moment that, like, all of a sudden, Rounder, everybody knew Rounder. Everybody knew after that. If you were like me and you were going to music stores and trying to play banjo, you got that album right away so you could aspire to greatness. Not that you could reach it, but that was the sound everybody wanted. And elevated, I think, like you said, there were artists that then became more available.
Yep.
Because that was such an important record.
Yep.
This gentleman right here has a question. Thank you.
Hi, I have a couple questions. One is, one of my favorite early Rounder records for almost 50 years has been the Vassar Clemens Crossing of the Catskills. And I was wondering, I got here a little late, but I was wondering if, I just love this sort of unproduced or not real produced quality of it, and they're just playing, and I love it.
Well, that was part of a series. Vassar and Tuck Taylor and Norman Blake were all in John Hartford's band at the time.
Yeah.
And John arranged for us to do records by each of them. And that's how it came about. It was done up in Cambridge. Fred Bartenstein, who many of you may know of, who's been very involved with IBMA, and he actually sang on it. I think he had a radio show at Hillbilly, right after Hillbilly at Harvard and Cambridge at the time.
And my other comment is, I was at the old schoolhouse for the Johnson Mountain Boys, and that...
First show or second?
I was in line for the first and in the second one. But that record is one of the great concert bluegrass records of all time. in my opinion.
Thank you. So this was going to be recorded and filmed, and for some reason the schoolhouse wouldn't let the sound people in early enough. And so the whole first show, which I remember as being better than the second, was not recorded. Something personal at the time, Dudley Connell, the lead singer of the Johnson Mountain Boys, insisted that Hazel Dickens and I sit in the first row, and usually I'm back as far as I can be, you know, all the way in the back. But Dudley knew that we reacted whenever he did a vocal turn that was somewhat different, and he wanted to get that immediate feedback, and so we were right there in the first row. And that's one of my favorite records too. The energy was just incredible, and just a wonderful record. Live at Luckett's was at the old schoolhouse. Yeah, Johnson Mountain Boys at the old schoolhouse, 0293, I think.
A lot of good questions. You're all welcome to come up whenever. Mm. We talked about the 0044 album. This was something that I was a little surprised by reading the book, is the success of the Hollerin' album.
Oh, I want to go back to 0044. Oh,
sure.
A nice story. For those who are familiar with 0044, there was a song called Summer Wages. And Jerry Douglas was not officially in the band at the time. He was still in the Country Gentlemen. And J.D. wasn't really Dobro-friendly. Ricky Skaggs really pushed him to get into these sessions. And he did Summer Wages. And everybody in the band was just, blown away by it, so much that all three singers forgot to come in at the end on the tagline. And we played it back, and everybody was praying, that they didn't lose time as well. But they kept in time, and they just went back in, took 5 minutes, put the three voices on, and the cut was saved.
Look at that. What a nice audience. They're going to put our...
Huh? You're up to Hollerin'.
Yeah, Hollerin'. Thank you for that. Somebody's putting one of our display stands up. That's what you get at Grey Fox, is happy people like that.
Yeah.
Hollerin', yeah. I was surprised of what a success that was at the point in time that it was. And explain a little bit about Hollerin', because I know what it is, but I didn't know anybody went and recorded it.
Yeah, Hollerin' was a mountain form of communication before they had phones in certain parts of the mountain. And so if someone was going to go down to the bottom of the hill, they might go, and this is terrible, go, ah! And that would be, people would recognize that as being, Charles Somers.
Or Tarzan in
Kansas. Yeah, they all had their own unique sounds. And there was a contest in Spivey's Corner, North Carolina, every year. And the winner usually came up and was on Johnny Carson every year. And so we decided to go down and record that, certainly, trying to fulfill our anti-profit.
Never losing track of that.
But it became a record store favorite when people wanted to close. So they'd put this thing on, and people would disperse. But it became, it got a fair amount of publicity, and certainly sold much better than we thought, and was profitable.
Surprise. And the cover is just a guy screaming.
Yeah, kind of mouth wide open.
Yeah. I was surprised that was as big a impact. But, again, Rounder had the idea, let's preserve and let's promote it as something that's important, and there's value to it. And
yep.
I think that's what you always strive to do. Do the good things that you like, and other people will like them. And if it goes on, that'll be great, and we'll just keep doing this for a while.
And it seemed like every few years we'd have something that would sell better and would help to make up for the ones that didn't do as well. And fortunately for us, I think most of the artists that did well understood that. George Thorogood, Alison Krauss, you know, they understood that, you know, we were not going to, you know, get a couple of new cars, but, you know, we'd be plowing it back into the business. And
for both of those artists, George Thorogood and Alison Krauss, it engendered a loyalty to them that lasted a long, long time, to where they would never do anything except with Rounder.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just because you pretty much, George Thorogood was out there, the way I read this, and looking for an opportunity, and there was a person that kept coming to you saying, you got to record this guy. And he's, everybody knows, if you know George Thorogood, his style of playing and singing. So you did it, and all of a sudden, two albums in, he's a huge star on the rock chart, which I just thought, how do those things happen?
Yeah, I went to a show in Cambridge at the Cantab Lounge. If we have anybody who goes to the Cantab. You know, they had a bluegrass series for a long time, and George played downstairs about the time that the record came out. I think it might have been his first gig. And there were five people there, including me and my date. So there were three other people. My date was the sister of David Hollander, who for a long time was at Berkeley and taught a lot of musicians and worked with a lot of bands coming out of Berkeley. Really, really nice guy.
There, first part of our interview with Ken Irwin up at Grey Fox on live stage. That was a lot of fun. So you gotta save some for next week with the part two of our interview with Ken Irwin. Thank you so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. Thank you for the very kind folks at Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival who said, we would like you to come and sit with Ken Irwin in front of an audience and interview him. And we had a good time. Thank you so much.